to 2 on 680 AM WISR and worldwide on the internet at WISR680.com. It's your turn, 724-283-2525. And now, it's your turn with Dave Malarkey.
Well, good afternoon once again, everyone, and welcome. Nice to have you with us on this. It almost feels like New Year's Eve. Yeah, that's still 2 days away, but that will be Sunday. next time we're together, however, will be the new year. Yeah, Monday. If you've been with us this week, you know that we have selected, and we've done this in past years, too. We've selected some of our interviews from the past several months, the past year, actually, that we thought were worthy of a second listen. And that's what we're doing this week. And boy, we have a couple of just dandy ones for you today. I'm so glad you could be with us. These interviews are just, they're too good to only air once. Pauly Shaw, we talked with Pauly Shaw, oh gosh, this summer, early summer, I'm thinking June maybe. Pauly Shaw wrote a book this year, published a book this year about Moraine State Park, the history of the park. Beautiful pictures in it with construction of the dam that made Lake Arthur possible, and pictures I've never seen before. So we'll talk with Pauly, take another listen to that interview coming up here in just a moment or so. And then we had a chance to talk early this year, it was quite some time ago, with Malachy McCourt, who is an Irish-American, he's a native of Ireland, but he lives in the United States now in New York. In fact, he ran for governor of New York some years ago on the Green Party, rather an ill-fated effort, but nonetheless he did. Malachy McCourt is the younger brother of the late Frank McCourt, who wrote the Pulitzer Prize-winning book, Angela's Ashes. Frank McCourt has now died. Malachy is still alive, and we had a chance to chat with him, and he's a very funny guy. Deadpan humor, just great stuff. So that's coming up a little bit later on the program today. We'll also talk with Tristan Gooley about recognizing signs in nature. But first things first, and that is a second listen to a wonderful interview that we had earlier this year with Pauly Shaw. So how did this all come about? How did you end up writing for Arcadia Publishers, a book about Moraine State Park, Pauly Shaw?
In the summer of 2015, Arcadia Publishing contacted Dustin Drew, who is the park manager mm-hmm. of Moraine State Park. Arcadia specializes in regional histories, local histories, but they cover the entire nation. They wanted to know if someone could be found locally who could take charge of producing this kind of book. So he went first to the support groups, the 3MJC and the Moraine Preservation Fund. And people thought, that's a great idea, but yet nobody apparently stepped up. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm a volunteer at McConnell's Mill. McConnell's Mill and Moraine are a complex. We share the same administration, rangers, everything.
And they are almost connecting. I'm not sure whether they actually do connect.
Almost. That was the plan. Originally, they wanted to, but that part was never realized.
Jennings is connected to Moraine.
At the other end.
Yeah, but McConnell's Mill doesn't quite hook up.
Almost. Mm-hmm. Almost. But I heard about this at the Heritage Festival, and I thought, that's an interesting thing. I could do that. So I went over and talked to Dustin Drew, the park manager. He showed me what he had from the publisher. We shook hands. That launched it. Mm. I contacted the acquisitions editor, and she guided me through the extensive application process.
Before I forget, is this book available in bookstores, online?
Yes.
Can they find it in libraries? Do you know where it is yet? It's just out for a couple of weeks now.
It just March 20th. Yeah. Yes, it's in the Butler Library. I placed a number of books in local libraries at the community college, mm-hmm. in the Butler Library, in the Slippery Rock Library, the Grove City Library, Newcastle Library, Elwood City Library, Cranberry Library, different places. Yes, it's definitely available in the libraries. It's available at Nicolette's Gift Shop, which is in Portersville. Mm-hmm. She is very close to Moraine State Park. It's available at Costco. Mm-hmm. I'll be doing a book signing there coming up next weekend. Not this weekend, but in a week from 11 to 1. It's available at Barnes & Noble in Cranberry. Mm-hmm. I'll be doing a book signing there on May 20th.
I'm lucky to get a hold of you. You're pretty busy these days.
It's available at Bear Run Campground. It's available, or it will be soon, at the Owlet Gift Shop, which is operated by the Moraine Preservation Fund, which is physically in Moraine State Park, mm-hmm. right there where you ride the Nautilus Nature.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, down on what is
they
it?
Haven't
McDaniels
opened
Launch,
yet.
Is that what that is?
McDaniels.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They haven't opened for the season, but I happen to know that they have books ready for when they open. Mm-hmm. It's also to be available at Jennings.
Okay.
I know they placed an order. Whether they have physically shown up in the shop yet, I'm not sure. Also, Super Styles in Harmony. I know that she has it because she's one of my biggest fans. And so she has it, too. Plus, you can buy it online from Arcadia Publishing. You can also buy it at Target.com and Amazon.com.
Excellent. Wow.
Yeah, kind of cool to find my name there on Amazon.
Yeah, yeah. I've seen some other Arcadia publications, generally of municipalities here and there, but this book has a totally different look to it.
It does.
Their other ones have kind of a, I don't know, it's
black
a standard.
And white.
Yeah, it's a standard cover. And, I mean, you really have to look to make sure you're getting the book that you want because they all look the same. This, in fact, has a beautiful color print on the front of Sailboat at Moraine.
They have a very large series called Images of America. And you're right, they're black and white or a tintype sort of.
Mm-hmm. That's kind of a
coloring
sepia thing.
Sepia.
Yeah.
And they are, there are several on Butler, postcards about Butler, many about local areas. Mm-hmm. But this is a very recent series. This is Images of Modern America. It does have some black and white photos, but most of them are color. Now, the picture on the cover is a vintage picture. I had a modern one that I wanted, but they want vintage picture. That's from 1970. Now, vintage is 1970 in terms of Moraine State Park, mm-hmm. which opened in 1970.
Well, you know, now that I look at it, and I didn't realize this before, but I can tell from the shoreline in the background that this is still when the park was in its infancy because
yes.
there are clearings there. It looks like the water level might not quite be up to where it was going to be as they were filling Lake Arthur. And I would not have realized that until you mentioned it, but that's kind of neat. I like the idea because, heck, you could go out there yourself with your camera and take pictures nowadays, but where are you going to get vintage pictures like this?
And yeah. on the back, you'll also see a vintage picture that shows the South Shore swimming area.
That's the big picture at the top on
the
back?
That's the big picture at the top. Now, there are people who comment that the park isn't used as much today, they think. Because they remember how crowded that beach was. When the park opened, there was only one beach opened, the South Shore Beach. The North Shore, the Lakeview Beach, wasn't open until several years later. Mm-hmm. That was put in 1973 for the Boy Scout Jamboree. In fact, they put several beaches on the North Shore, but only the one sandy beach remains. So instead of having everybody at one beach, now you've got them separated by two beaches, and there's been a lot more development. Mm-hmm. The park is very large, so you can have a lot of people there, and you really don't see each other.
It's a good point, because the two swimming beaches that are there now are on opposite sides of the lake.
Yes.
And you can't even see one from the other. So, when the park first opened, it would have looked a lot more crowded on that solitary beach. Plus, I can remember on warm Saturdays or Sundays in the summer, in the early days, or at least several years into the history of Moraine State Park, they used to shut off the entrance after so many people got in there.
I do remember that everybody was going to South Shore.
It's the only place you could go to swim.
That was the developed place. But now that there's so much on the North Shore, there's swimming, the two marinas, picnic shelters, mm-hmm. the disc golf. There's a lot going on the North Shore, so you don't even access it from the South Shore. You have to access it from the other side. With some state parks, there's one road that encircles the entire park. Moraine is different. We're the third largest state park within Pennsylvania, and it doesn't have one road that goes around. There's 42 miles just of shoreline. So you come in from different roads. So people on the North Shore don't really see except across the lake.
You can look across the lake and see the Bear Run boat launch area from the North Shore, but otherwise you would have no idea how large that that lake is. In fact, I once flew over it when I was flying to Boston, and the air traffic pattern that day, when you took off from Pittsburgh International, you take off, you go over the nuclear plant at Shippenport, you make you hang a big right turn headed to Boston, and you fly right over Moraine State Park. And I looked, in fact, I have some fantastic pictures that I shot out the window of the plane. And that really gives you an idea of the size of Lake Arthur. Much, much bigger than you realize from any point on shore.
3,225 acres.
We're talking with Polly Shaw, if you're joining us a little bit late. Polly is from the Portersville area, right? Portersville area. And she has written a marvelous, I'm not exaggerating when I use that that adjective, a marvelous history of Moraine State Park, a pictorial history, but with quite a bit of text. I hesitate to even say captions of pictures, because they're really paragraphs, extended captions with a lot of text in there. Did you write all of those yourself?
I wrote everything that's in there.
Everything, huh?
There is a very standard format to which I had to adhere for the publisher's work in this series. I could have an introduction that was not more than, say, 2 pages. Then each chapter, and I could have between 4 and 7 chapters. I ended up with 5. But I could have an introduction, but I was limited to how much I could put in that introduction. So in laying out my story, I had to figure out what I wanted to get in the introduction for that particular chapter, and the rest of the story is carried through the captions. There's no more narrative later on in the chapter.
That would actually be harder, I think, and if I've never written a book, but that would be more difficult to say what you wanted to say in that strict format, as opposed to just saying, okay, write 50 pages. You know, that would be a piece of cake, really.
That was their format, and I was limited into how many words I could put in the caption. So sometimes that's one picture with a longer caption, or there may be 2 pictures that share a caption, or there could be 2 or even 3 pictures that each have a caption.
Where'd you get all the photographs, by the way? They're marvelous.
I was so fortunate. Because I have the long-standing relationship with the park, being 20 years at the mill, they very kindly opened up the archives for me. There are several thousand slides. Almost all of the picture records from the development in the park are on slides. So then I had to get a slide viewer. I've acquired a lot of things in conjunction with this. But I got a slide viewer. The slides are not particularly organized. They were labeled. But you couldn't go to it and say, here are the pictures for this idea, or there are the pictures for that. That's going to be coming. We're now working on getting those organized and cataloged so that actually anybody in the state park system would be able to call up pictures. But that hasn't been done yet. I had to do it by going through slide by slide. So we have many pictures of men walking across the grass. This is going to be such and such in the future. Well, you really can't fill a book with those kind of pictures.
No, that would get boring real fast.
But I was very fortunate that they documented the building of the dam. So, and that's, I have a few of those in the book. So you can see where they had to reroute Muddy Creek, where they built part of the dam, where they then shifted the water to go through the sluice gate so that they could and build a cofferdam to keep the water to half the channel so they could build the rest of the dam.
You know, a lot of folks don't even know where the dam is that created Lake Arthur, which actually it's not hard to believe, because it's almost hidden from view. It's not really visible from any, you can't see it from 422 when you're flying by.
No, really, it's just a out of the site.
It's not very far from 422.
No, it's very close.
Not very far from the McDaniel's launch at the North Shore. It's very, in fact, you can walk. I have.
Yes.
From McDaniel's launch to the dam. But a lot of people don't have no idea where it is. Yeah. Well, and you have a picture in here. I was thumbing through my review copy, and it was one of the first things I saw. It's the building of the, well, this particular one is I-79 and 422. 422, of course, the original Route 422, went from Butler to Newcastle, as it still does, but it would have been underwater because the location of the original highway is now where the lake is.
Now, that's a very interesting point. When they got the idea, let's recreate this glacial lake. Well, you have to decide, after they got approval for the project, where will the dam go? The dam, there were four locations considered. One of them was right at Isle, which would have been on 528.
That's this is a little town, village,
little
hamlet,
town,
by the
village,
way.
Yes.
Isle, yeah, this village of Isle.
That would be at the confluence of Shannon Run and Swamp Run, where they flow into Muddy Creek. That would have made a fairly small lake. They also had one further down, closer to Big Run, we'll say halfway down.
Mm-hmm.
That would have made a larger lake. Or they considered one at Portersville Station. That's from the old Western Allegheny Railroad, which 9 miles of that old railroad right-of-way runs right under the lake. They considered that place. That would have made the largest lake. So they had to first decide that. Then they thought they would put it at Portersville Station. Unfortunately, the ground wasn't right. They thought that perhaps there was too much limestone. Mm-hmm. Limestone tends to fracture. It makes caves. You can't really build a successful dam on that. So that place was out. Then they ended up with where it is right now, which does have limestone, but it's also covered by clay. The clay is a deposit from the glacial lake
mm-hmm.
that was here 20,000 years ago.
But this is just... this is so fascinating. I'm so glad I was able to hook up with you and talk about this. I'm so glad that you've written this book. Listeners, if you're joining us a little bit late, that's fine. No problem. Dave Malarkey is my name. Pauly Shaw is with us, author of Moraine State Park, part of the Images of Modern America series published by Arcadia and just published a little over three weeks ago. But it is available already. In stores and online. You can't talk about Moraine State Park without talking about how it came about. I mean, this is a wonderful thing. It's a huge, as you mentioned, I didn't realize it was the third largest state park in the state of Pennsylvania.
Yes, it is.
It's really big. So, but most of this land, virtually 99% of it, was privately owned, right? So it had to be purchased or acquired or...
It was acquired.
Somehow. And wasn't that the Western Pennsylvania Conservancy that got involved in that?
When they first formally were talking about this idea with Dr. Frank Preston.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Frank Preston, John Eisler of Butler, Otto Jennings, and some other people, they said, this is a good idea. And then reality sort of hits. How are we going to acquire this land? There were several groups, and they realized that one group needed to be formed that could acquire the land. That led to the founding of the Western Pennsylvania Conservancy, which was formally changed to that name in 1951. So then they could begin to see about acquiring land. Dr. Frank Preston himself donated a large tract of land. He also bought other tracts of land, which he gave. They hired a land agent who then went around talking with people. And for stories I read that a farmer would say, no, I'm not going to sell you. I need that. That's part of my pasture.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy looked at him and said, look, your cows were stuck in the mud down there last spring. He was a local man. He knew.
Yeah.
So he was able to work with people and to help to acquire all that land, which was necessary to eventually put together the park. Now, yes, it's certainly absolutely true. Some people not happy about this. but a lot of them retired, moved to Florida, moved elsewhere, houses were moved. And that brings us back to why the highway was moved. Mm-hmm. When I mentioned that there were different places, if the dam had been placed on the eastern end, they would not have had to move 422. But they went for the bigger lake. And 422 came right in by Big Run, went right, would be the middle of the lake now, and headed on west. So that had to be removed. Now, the thing here, that three-lane 422 had just been put in 10 years before.
Wow, I never knew that.
So would the state agree to move a highway that's only 10 years old? But it had a problem. Fog. Horrible, horrible fog.
Because of what was just a creek, Muddy Creek at that
because time. Because it ran parallel to the creek in mm-hmm. a lowland. I have read it would take 2 hours to go from Butler to Newcastle because of the fog. Hmm. But that's not the only road that was a problem. Interstate 79 had not yet been built, but it had been planned. And the route planned for 79 would have taken it through the lake. So they had to get approval to move a 6 mile stretch of 422 and move it south above the lake level, and they had to get approval to move 79 further west so that it skirts the lake but does not go through it.
You have a marvelous picture in here of when they were just doing the earth moving to put 422, you know, the limited access four-lane highway that it now is, in there, and there's no pavement, there's no nothing, it's just these huge piles of dirt that they mm-hmm. were moving to build that highway. I've been told by people who lived here at that time, I did not, that as they started to fill the lake, you know, they finished the dam, closed the sluice gates, and okay, now slowly we're filling Lake Arthur, that you could drive on the old Route 422, you could drive right down to the edge of the water, and then the pavement just disappeared under the water, and you could come back a week later, and you couldn't go down that far because, you know, the water was higher by then.
When I showed those pictures to Dustin Drew, our current park manager, he was astounded that could have been allowed back in 1969 and 70.
I've talked to friends of mine who were kids then. Who said they did it? I mean, that was like a Friday night date. You'd
get yes.
the car and you'd drive as far as you could on 422 right down to the edge of the water.
Coming in from both ways.
Yeah.
Coming
yeah.
in from west, coming in from east. They would drive at first right through the water and then they'd have to stop. And it was quite a thing for boats to go over the surface of the water while the cars were all sitting there. You would not get to do that today.
When Frank Preston, what a genius, by the way, and what, you know,
yes.
and what a legacy he leaves for us who remain here in Butler County, including most recently through the generosity of his late wife, Jane, Preston Park in Butler Township.
Beautiful place.
Which is now a huge, huge municipal park. It was their homestead. I mean, they lived in the middle of that, and his workshops and everything were in there, right?
He originally had bought this large tract of land on what was called Whippoorwill Hill Road. It's called Chrisley Road. This was before he married.
Mm-hmm.
He loved that. It overlooked Isle, which is at 528, where the big bridge is. He wanted to build a homestead then. But World War II, this is not the time to be building houses. Then he marries in 1943 or 4. He marries, and he tells his wife, I've got this land, I'd like to build this house. And no, because there were oil wells, there were coal mines, and she found the country to be too rough. This was not a place that she wanted to live. She had come up, a city girl from mm-hmm. Ohio. No, she didn't want to live there. Well, he'd already started Preston Laboratories. It was first in East Butler, on the East Butler Road. Then he moved to Meridian. They had a caretaker at the place in Meridian. They were still living in an apartment on McCain Street, I believe, downtown Butler. And that's when he was wanting to build this house, and she says no. But the caretaker, who was a good friend, sadly passed away. So they thought, okay, well, I really don't want to build that house out there. And now we have an apartment at Preston Park. what we call it today. So that's how they came to live there. So when you go to Preston Park, you may expect to see a lovely home. And in fact, he does have a lovely set of gates. That's his English background. Mm-hmm. He has this lovely set of gates, but they never actually built a home. They used the caretaker's apartment, which was on the second floor. So you can go and visit the laboratories. They're still very rough. It was only 5-6 years ago that this property was acquired. Mm-hmm. Not sure of that date. Not too long ago, acquired by Butler Township. So don't go there expecting to see rooms the way they had them and the laboratories the way they had them. Maybe they'll get to that part someday, but not yet. But the grounds are why you go.
Fascinating couple, actually. Jane Preston, I never talked to Dr. Frank Preston, but his widow, Jane, was a regular listener to this program. And on occasion, she would call me up and set me straight on this issue or another. And we became, you know, pretty good friends because of that. I never got to sit down and talk with her about, you know, the incredible history. Dr. Frank Preston, his work at Preston Labs and so on and so forth, that eventually evolved into what we now know as AGR, right?
Yes.
American Glass Research. Out on Route 68. Well, another story, but you know, I can refer to him, and I don't think this is a stretch. He had the same philosophy as somebody like Bill Gates. He was a brilliant man, a wealthy man, and yet very philanthropic. Donated land, donated money, came up with these ideas of let's recreate this glacial lake. I mean, my gosh, what a dreamer! But he did it.
He was the right man in the right place at the right time. But I think part of that came from his background. He grew up in Leicester, England.
I didn't know he was English. No.
Yes. Huh. Definitely born in England. And about 1896 or so, he attended school, Wiggiston Boys School. For those of you who are park enthusiasts, you may recognize the name Wiggiston Trail, which is near the region office, and also goes up on Wickerwill Hill, which is the ground that he owned. But he named that trail after his boys school. He was there starting at age 12 or 11, and World War I was coming in, the Great War.
Mm-hmm.
Some of his classmates and other boys in the school went on to serve in that war. Two of the masters, the teachers from the school, served in the war. Many of them were lost. So after the war, Frank and his classmates decided that it would be appropriate if they would dedicate themselves toward public service, toward giving back, do it twice as much to make up for what their classmates who had fallen would never be able to do.
Wow.
So I have read his book, Boys of the Old Brigade, which refers back to his time at school, but it's his personal journals. They are, and anybody can read it, but there's only one copy that I know of.
Mm-hmm.
It is bound. It's in the section of the Butler Library, the kind of section where you have to use hand sanitizer, mm-hmm. and you will sit here at the table.
Mm-hmm.
They are definitely in special collections.
Why don't you tell that story? I'm sure you've seen the film Goodbye, Mr. Chips. Do you know that mm-hmm. wonderful film? Where the boys' school in England, and some of them go off to war and are killed. And it's a great flick, by the way.
Yes.
So how did Frank Preston end up emigrating to America?
When he was in college, and he has, as we know, a doctorate, and he holds master's and several degrees, he started working for a glass company in England. That glass company must have been working with somebody in America and sent Frank at age 22 to a company here mm-hmm. in, I think it was New York State. He worked there for a while, and then he went to Franklin Glass, again still working for his employer
mm-hmm.
in England, but he's now assigned to Franklin Glass because he had some special skills, special techniques. So that's how he came to Butler.
Hmm.
He was working for Franklin Glass.
Which, folks, if you're not from around here or haven't lived here all that long. It was a huge glass factory on the outskirts of Butler, which burned down, I don't know, 30 years ago or something
like
that.
But it was a huge business.
Yeah.
He never intended to stay. He was just, oh, I'm an Englishman, and I'm here, and I'm doing this work. He really didn't find close friends here. He was interested in birds. Ornithology was a lifelong hobby of his. He was interested in nature. He was interested in geology. But he had acquaintances. And one summer night, 1922, a friend from work said, "It's a hot day. Let's take a drive to Slippery Rock. Let's get some ice cream." Now, Frank didn't have a car, so even getting to ride in a car to go for ice cream was pretty nice. So they're heading up what we today would call Route 8 North, and they're passing through Muddy Creek Flats.
Mm-hmm.
He recognizes the landscape. Those of you who are very local and have traveled up there know that you come down a big hill, there is 0.7 of a mile of totally flat land, and then you go back up again. He recognized that as the basin of a glacial lake, because Leicester, England is likewise located on the basin of a glacial lake. In that case, and it was the same glacier we had, the same glacial period, that backed up the River Dart. Ours backed up Muddy Creek. So he recognized this. On a different outing, he went with friends. Now they're at McConnell's Mill. He recognized where Alpha Pass would be, where this glacial lake would have released the water.
And created the Slippery Rock Creek Gorge.
Yes.
Wow.
So this is, and that glacial lake, 70 feet higher and 8 miles longer than today's Lake Arthur.
So all of this because he decided he was going to go with a friend to get ice cream.
Yes.
And from that incredible piece of luck, he came up with the idea of recreating this glacial lake, which became for us Lake Arthur Moraine State Park. Wow.
He put it in the back of his head. Again, he wasn't going to stay here. He was going to go back to England. But he did go back to England in 1925, received his doctorate degree, took a year's world tour, came back here to Butler, and decided to open his own business. He was not a manufacturing, he was research.
Mm-hmm.
So now he's 1927-8, he's got a company for 10 years, and he's thinking, I do seem to be staying. So let's build a bigger laboratory, and that's how he moved to Meridian. And then he decides he will acquire his citizenship. He acquired a fiance, and now he's got a very successful business, successful to the point that he can now step back a bit. And that's when he can really return to this early interest. He loved geology. He's made these discoveries, but now they're to the forefront and he has time. His wife would drive sometimes. She would sit in the car eating apples and reading books while he's out trying to determine the lake edge of the glacial lake. He's mapping all this out. So this was not a whim that he said, oh, let's make a lake. He did a tremendous amount of personal study. He would go into Pittsburgh. He would talk to Otto Jennings. He would talk to others at the Carnegie Museum and at the University of Pittsburgh, learning. This man was a lifelong learner. I like to think I'm a bit of a lifelong learner, but this man was working at a much higher level than any of us.
These are wonderful stories. I'm enthralled here as I sit listening to Pauly Shaw. We need to take a break. We're going to have to readjust our program a little bit here. Can you stick with us a little bit longer?
Yes,
are you okay
I can.
With that? Our next guest will be here at the bottom of the hour, and that will be George Pry and Judy Novak. But I'm going to keep Pauly here simply because I have too many more things to talk to her about.
Including my mother.
Including your mom, yes. We're going to talk about your mom. So let's take a quick break here. And it's nice to have you along with us here on It's Your Turn today. And we'll talk more with our guest, our wonderful guest, Pauly Shaw, in just a moment or so.
At Tri-Rivers Musculoskeletal Centers, our orthopedic surgeons, sports medicine specialists, physiatry, and rheumatology experts are committed to your health. Whether it's joint pain, a sports injury, a worker's comp injury, or you need help managing your arthritis or chronic pain, their physicians provide high-quality care to patients in 7 locations, including 2 right here in Butler and 1 in Slippery Rock. Tri-Rivers accepts most major insurance plans, including Highmark and UPMC. Learn more at TriRiversMSK.com. Tri-Rivers Musculoskeletal Centers, partnering with the Butler community for more than 20 years.
Welcome back, folks. Paulie Shaw's with us. Paulie, I think your next book should be about Frank Preston. You could sit down with a word processor right now and crank out a little brochure on his life.
Actually, my next book will be on McConnell's Mill State Park.
Ah, oh, wonderful.
I'm not to submit a proposal until at least late fall. They like 6 months between the publication of one book before they look at a proposal for a next book. But I've already started to do some research, learning new things about McConnell's Mill. I've been there 20 years, and yet there's still so many more things to learn. I know about the building, the hill, the actual historic mill, mm-hmm. but I've been learning about the Polish Falcon Camp. I didn't know about it.
I didn't
I'm learning
either.
About it.
I knew that it was a working mill, obviously, with the power of the Slippery Rock Creek going through that gorge there. By the way, Paulie Shaw, you were a teacher. You were
37 years, Seneca Valley School District.
Mm-hmm. Good for you. And now she has a little time to write, and that's good for us. I want to talk about your mom. Your mom was Margot Pitts, the late Margot Pitts. I was very close to your mom. She was one of my mentors when I came out of school and started in this business. She was at WISR then. And as I mentioned earlier, even after she became a professor at Butler County Community College, she still had her hand in radio. I talked to your mom about this. I've talked to others about her. When she started at WISR, she was one of the very few women working in radio.
Very few. Mm-hmm. She started, I believe, in the 1945, 46. I'm not exactly sure what year they moved to Butler, because I wasn't here yet. But she started there doing a woman's program, and somehow that grew into Cheerio. That was the name of her little show. And then she became a regular disc jockey. She has told me that she was the first woman's disc jockey in Western Pennsylvania. So she had a regular show. She also did the news when required. She has told me that actually on May 14th on a certain year, she did the 12 o'clock news, and I was born at 2:25. same day.
There's also a story. In fact, one of our listeners sent me an email earlier this week when I was promoting the fact that you were going to be on, and said that she remembered Margot's program called Polly's Playhouse.
Yes.
There has to be a connection there, Polly, or maybe not. I don't know.
There definitely is. In the late 40s, they did a live program. They had Bob Kaufman, and they had a puppet of some sort, and they had music, and they have school children come to that big back room at the old WISR building at 357 North Main, where I grew up. And they would have these live kids come in, and they would do a program. For several years, this went on. And then when I was forecast, somehow they all thought, well, Polly's Playhouse, this should be Polly. And that's how my name came along.
Wow. What a story. What a story. Yeah, the at the rear of the old WISR building on Main Street, there was a gargantuan studio.
Yes.
Huge. And it was all soundproofed and everything with double glass and all that stuff looking into the control room. But in the early days of radio, when WISR signed on in 1941, You didn't have records. I mean, most of the music, at least for the early few years, was live. You had live bands in there. Remember, there was a grand piano in there. Remember
there
that?
There was.
Yeah.
But they did also then put in the record shelves.
Mm-hmm.
And there were, on two walls, many, many, many records. And she would have to go and pull her records that she would be putting on for that hour, 2 hours, and then go back, and she had to put them back in. And I remember they had a machine that could cut records.
Mm-hmm.
It was on the back wall. And so it was of an interview or of a live performance, they would cut the record right there.
Yeah, this was before magnetic tape.
Yes.
Which is, of course, not used anymore either. But those were called electronic transcriptions. And they were huge machines. I never used them, but I've seen pictures of them. Well, anyway, fond memories of Margot, and she was of great help to me and very kind to me. And we did some theater shows together, too, because we had a mutual avocational interest in community theater. Well, for me, it was an avocation. For your mom, my goodness, she lived and died for theater.
She loved it. She directed, she performed, she produced, did the publicity.
She was the managing director of the Silver Fox Playhouse up in
St.
Petersburg.
Yeah? 25 years. Mm-hmm. 25 years, we never went anywhere on a Saturday because that was theater night
in
the summer.
And she was there for every weekend
at
Silver Fox. Yeah.
And she had, some of your listeners will remember, she never repeated an outfit. She never repeated the shoes. She would come out like Loretta Young.
She was dressed to the nines.
She was. That's what she did.
Yeah.
And so she arranged for all of those plays, but she introduced them. She was a personality, and she loved it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Good memories, good memories. When did your mom pass away?
1999.
I couldn't remember. Somebody asked me today. This is, again, the buzz you created about being here. Somebody said, well, when did Margot die? And I said, boy, I don't know off the top of my head.
That date would be coming up, April 30th, 1999.
So that's 18 years ago, something like that?
She was in fairly good health until she developed some severe eye problems and had surgery that did not go well, cataract surgery that failed. They said 1 in 1,000 would fail. She failed. And that led in about 6 months. It was quite a downslope. But I will tell you, because she had failed cataract surgery, my sister and I both have had cataract surgery, and we faced it with a little bit of trepidation.
Yeah, I can imagine.
But that was way back in about 1998 when she had that. Ours was much more recent. My sister and I, no problems.
Mm-hmm.
Very happy to say that.
Well, Margot, your mom was I'm not stretching the point. She was a Renaissance woman. She was a pioneer in terms of her gender in radio. And she was later a professor at, in fact, she was one of the first professors at Butler County Community College. She taught what, psychology?
She taught psychology. She held a master's degree in psychology from Columbia University in New York City. She also taught English. She taught specialized courses for nurses. She also started as a lecturer, became an instructor, associate professor, assistant professor, whichever order those go in, and she retired a full professor. Every time she was eligible for promotion, she achieved it.
And all of this despite being an actor, director, producer, and theater manager in community theater in a variety of Butler Little Theater, Musical Theater Guild, Silver Fox, all over the place.
And being very active with her grandchildren.
Yeah.
She had 5 grandchildren, and definitely with my 2 older nephews, and then mine came along. I have 3 who are now grown, and I'm the grandmother.
Well, I'm glad to talk about your mom for a while. I think about her every once in a while, and I haven't had a chance. I've never had a chance to talk to you about it, since I haven't seen you in who knows how many years. Pauly Shaw is here. When I got, actually, I did not talk to Pauly. I got a book in the mail, and it was, must have been a month and a half ago
from the publicist.
Arcadia, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I opened it up, and I said, oh, look at this, Marine State Park. And then I saw your name on the front by Pauly Shaw. So I said, well, there we go. Now, I didn't contact you right away because they had sent it to me in advance to review, and it didn't. You know, it wasn't going to be released until late March. So I wanted to wait until people could actually get a copy of this after we talked about it. The pictures in here are magnificent. Most of them are, by the way, they're all season. They are most of them in color. In fact, I haven't come on a black and white one yet.
Just a very few in the beginning, but they are all season. I made a point to do that.
Yeah, there's summer, winter, the ice boats, the ice fishing on the lake. I haven't seen the ice boats in recent years. I don't know whether they're still out there much or not anymore.
Well, not this winter.
That's true. There weren't even any ice fishermen this year. Well.
But we did. There's a winter fest, a big program in January, February yearly. There is the summer Lake Arthur Regatta. But I was very fortunate with the pictures. Not, the majority do come from the park archives. But I also had pictures from Charlene Reinhart and from John Keck, from Thomas Teft, Margie Opp, Ginny Whipple, and Jonathan Timbo Jallo. Now, I must tell you that last name happens to be my grandson.
Hmm.
But in fact, he was out with me. We have been on every trail. And Jonathan was there, and he took two of the pictures.
Hmm.
He actually took the picture because I'm in one of them. You might think of Where's Waldo? Look for me in the book. Jonathan took the picture and another one adjacent to it.
So, finally, Frank Preston's dream came to reality.
Yes.
I'm sure eventually, even though the Western Pennsylvania Conservancy people started buying up land, and by the way, they didn't steal people's property. They paid them for it.
They paid,
yes. They bought the property, and then various parcels were cobbled together, and finally we had enough land for this, first of all, the lake, and then the park. I think most people around here know that the name Moraine State Park comes from the terminal moraine, mm-hmm. which was the southernmost point of the glacier,
yes.
During the most recent ice age. It was the most recent ice age, right?
It would be the most recent, mm-hmm. but we had the third and the fourth glaciers both came to this area. Not too much known about the first two because the third and fourth obliterated it.
Yeah, when the glacier advances southward, it pushes rocks, boulders, trees, junk, everything. It's like a giant bulldozer, really, but a living bulldozer. And when the glacier reached its southern point, its southern terminus, it never went any further south. Then it starts to melt away, mm-hmm. go back to the north, and what you have left is all the detritus that was being pushed by the glacier, the rocks, the soil, everything else, and that's called terminal moraine, right?
Not only did it leave all of that, but the glacier blocked those north-flowing streams. Slippery Rock Creek used to flow north.
Get out, really?
Weirdly. Ah. Wolf Creek used to flow north. Muddy Creek used to flow north. And so they're trying to flow north. Here comes the glacier. That's where the glacial lakes came from. So now we've got an extensive amount of water. Extensive. Lake Watts, which is the much larger Lake Arthur, Lake Edmund, which would have covered Harrisville, Slippery Rock, Grove City, a much larger area. As this glacier is receding, this water is released. And that water being released suddenly formed the Slippery Rock Gorge. But that's going to be in the next book.
That's right, because that flows right through the middle of McConnell's Mill.
And I will definitely be dealing a lot more with the glacial effect and how those all came to be in the next book.
You've mentioned a couple of times the name. Actually, you've mentioned several names that people would recognize. There was an Eisler. I forget the
John Eisler.
John Eisler.
Yes.
Everybody would know that name around here. You mentioned Otto Jennings. That's O-T-T-O, the man's name, Otto Jennings. And if you're thinking Jennings Environmental Education Center,
yes.
Yeah, that's him.
That's
named
him.
After him. What about Lake Arthur? Where the heck did that name come from?
That name came from Edmund Watts Arthur. Now, Edmund Watts Arthur was a lawyer from Pittsburgh. When he was in his 20s, he acquired tuberculosis. So after a year in a sanatorium, his doctor said, you need to be outdoors more. So he started in his legal work handling coal leases. So that takes him outdoors more.
Mm-hmm.
He's now handling these coal mines and so forth in this area. He's also interested in geology. He's also exploring the same area.
That Frank Preston,
but the two didn't know each other. They didn't meet until 1946. Then they start exploring together. They put their ideas together, and they were both thinking about this glacial lake. Frank Preston was wanting to recreate it. Edmund Watts Arthur had also thought that Portersville Station would be an ideal place. He arrived at that idea independently from Preston. But now you've got these two powerhouses putting their ideas together. Sadly, 1948, Edmund Watts Arthur died, dropped dead of a heart attack outside his law office in Pittsburgh. So it was about 2 weeks after that, the passing of Edmund Watts Arthur, that Frank Preston calls John Eisler and calls Jennings and calls these other people together to talk about the lake. And they had wanted to name something in honor of Edmund Watts Arthur. At first, it was going to be a trail. Let's do better than the trail. That's where the name Arthur comes from.
Wow.
Edmund Watts Arthur, his very good friend. Now, Edmund Watts Arthur had a geologic hammer that he used in his work. When he died, it was presented to presented to Frank Preston. And he had, there was the story about Excalibur with King Arthur and Excalibur. So he had engraved on it Excalibur. And at the dedication ceremony on May 23rd, 1970, Frank Preston presents this geologic hammer to Paul Feathers, who was the park manager in charge during the time of the construction. And the instructions were, row out to the middle of the lake sometime. Throw that hammer into the lake. Throw Excalibur back into the lake to return Excalibur back to Arthur. So they were very big on the story from England. And that's where that comes from.
Folks, these stories are so incredible. It's in the book, Moraine State Park,
yes,
for goodness sakes, with pictures, tons of them. Our time runs very short here, and I haven't asked you about a timeline here. I don't want specific dates, November 16th or whatever, but Frank Preston and the others started dreaming about this. It would have been in the 40s, I guess.
In the late 1940s. Uh-huh. And it... in the mid-1960s, work was really getting underway. Plans, moving 422, moving the plan for 79, new bridge for 528, getting all that land acquired. And they started filling the lake in 1969 on May 15th. They closed the gate.
How long did it take to fill it after they closed the sluice gate on the dam?
11 months.
Wow. Not very long, actually.
No, they thought it would take longer. There were people who thought it would never happen. But in fact, it did. 11 months to fill. Dedication was May 23rd, 1970.
Wow. Wow. And it still doesn't cost anything to get in.
It is free.
Absolutely.
Our state
free.
Parks are free. If you register for a program that might have consumable materials, you might have to pay for a specific program for something, but to use the park to take advantage of all of its recreational opportunities, that's free.
I have kept you longer than I promised, but I wanted to talk about the book, the park, Frank Preston, the whole process you went through of 'cause this is your first book.
Yes.
Right? You're a retired teacher, so, you know, we know where you're coming from here, but still, your first one. Just to chat. I wanted to chat about your mom, too. And I really, really enjoyed having you here. I really did.
Thank you so much. And a special hello to all of her listeners who remember her from this station.
Again, your book is available. The title is Moraine State Park. Easy enough.
Easy enough.
Arcadia Publishers. And it's available in a lot of local places around here. Polly, you want to run through that list again for me?
Nicolette's in Portersville. Superstyles in Harmony. It will be available at the Owlet Gift Shop at Moraine. It will be available at the Jennings Gift Shop if it's not there already. You can also get it online at Arcadia Publishing, at Amazon.com, and at Target.com.
Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much.
If you don't come back when you publish the next one on McConnell's Mill, I'm going to be mad.
2 years. 2 to 3 years, I will be here for that book.
Count on it. Thanks, Polly.
Thank you so much.
More to come on It's Your Turn. Stick around. Hey, folks, do you realize how long Miller's Shoes has been a presence on Main Street in downtown Butler? Would you believe 125 years? Yes. They're celebrating their 125th anniversary. Families have been shopping for quality and value at Miller's Shoes for well over a century. They're at 215 South Main Street in downtown Butler. And with winter weather on us, Miller's Shoes is your headquarters for overshoes and boots for the bad weather. Timberland Shoes and Boots, for example. Many other famous name brands, too. Rockport, Trotters, and all of your famous name brand athletic shoes. Miller's Shoes, also your local headquarters for America's favorite comfort shoes, SAS Shoes. You'll find them for men and women, various styles and colors, at Miller's Shoes. And don't forget, for gift giving, gift certificates. What a great idea for a holiday gift for someone special. A gift certificate from Miller's Shoes. Stop in, talk to Jimmy Chipran and the folks at Miller's Shoes, 215 South Main Street in downtown Butler, now celebrating their 125th anniversary. What a pleasure it is, listeners, to be able to chat for the next few minutes here on the It's Your Turn program on WISR with our guest who visits with us on a telephone. By the way, if you're joining us a little bit late on the program today, that's fine. My name is Dave Malarkey. Our guest is Malachy McCourt, and we want to talk about his latest book called Death Need Not Be Fatal. And if you want to chuckle a little bit at that title, you are most welcome to. Malachy, what a pleasure it is to talk to you today. Thanks so much for spending a little bit of time with us today.
Well, it's great to talk to you again. I think it's 20 years since we last, or more, since we exchanged a few words there, Dave, in Pittsburgh.
It's true. We did. I saw a show that you wrote with your late brother, Frank McCourt. It was called A Couple of Blackguards. And
right.
I saw it when you played in Pittsburgh. And I would guess that's about right, about 20 years or so ago.
It must have been, yeah. So yeah. That was a most hospitable and delightful welcome we got, and here we go again.
I can remember that evening. I took several friends who knew nothing about Irish heritage to that show, and they just had a blast. They still talk about it, as a matter of fact. That was great fun.
I think that evening you composed the entire audience, as far as I remember. For some reason, we didn't get too much publicity, so very few people. But you came, so you have been canonized, Dave, in my head, anyway. And so that's it, St. Dave Malarkey. And there's nothing you can do about that now.
That's a good Irish name, as I'm sure you know. A lot of folks here in the United States get a little bit of a chuckle about my name. That's fine.
Well, it is. People, I find it very odd about that, Dave, that people are... You have heard all the what passes for jokes or comments on your name. And people, you know, some jerks think that they've been totally original. When they tell you, oh, you're on radio, so you must be pulling Malarkey. They give him a kick in the arse, you know, shut up. And my name, of course, Malachy, is fairly close to that. And I get the same thing, you know. Do you know what they should call you? And I hear it coming, and I say, oh, just hold on. And I pull out, I have a notebook in my back pocket for various things. I said, let me put your name down. To join the other 9,437 others that said that.
Well, I had the great pleasure, just a quick story, and then I want to get to talking about your book here. Several years ago, when I was attending a summer school in Ireland, I had a great pleasure of meeting Nobel laureate Seamus Heaney.
Oh, yes, yeah.
Actually, I was having him sign, it was his translation of Beowulf, which he had just published,
oh
and I was
God,
having,
it, yeah.
having him sign it for me, and he couldn't quite get the spelling of my name, so I showed him my name card from the school, and he said, oh, Malarkey, he said, yes, our mailman used to be Malarkey, so he knew the name, that's weird.
Yeah.
Well, listen, goodness gracious, I don't want to yap on here, because I want to chat with you about your latest book. It's your third, I believe.
Tenth.
Your tenth?
Yes.
Oh, my goodness. I'm way behind the times here.
Well, then that's the third memoir. You're right on that department. Yeah, it's the third memoir. Yeah.
So,
but I wrote a history of Ireland as well, and I wrote the history of Danny Boy and the history of the Clatter Ring, and I wrote a collection of Irish literature, and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
I just started, you know, and it... I had no intentions of being a writer, but of course, when somebody called up and said, a friend of my brother's actually, said, you must have a book in you too. You know, it was Arthur Frank's enormous success with Angela's Ashes. So I didn't, I had been doing an acting business over the years and on, like yourself, on a radio host and doing saloon keeper and so on, but writing was not in my purview. So anyway, I sat down and I wrote a book, and it hit the bestseller list. So I said, oh, well, this is a nice way of making a living, so why not do that too? Because it's very easy. People talk about getting writer's block and everything else, and of course, I'm like a child. I leap from one subject to another. I have the concentration of a mad mouse. You know, I just go running off all over the bloody place.
Well,
so I've been doing quite well, and I write in longhand. So I know. So then this. A friend of mine, another friend, and that's this. I'm very lucky. I have friends who are considerate and look after you. And he said, "I have an editor that would like to get a book with you." And so that's how this one started.
Well, a lot of our listeners may hear the title "Death Need Not Be Fatal," and they're thinking, "Oh gosh, that sounds maybe a little bit morbid."
Well, you know, Dave, in Ireland. I was going to call it, in Ireland, you know, at my age, I'm 85, and so when you get to my age, they say you're in the departure lounge. So I was going to call it that, but they said, well, maybe they'll think it's about airlines and so forth, so we changed death need not be fatal, so... But it's not, you know, because, you know, Mark Twain put it very nice. He said he was about in the atmosphere for millions of years, and then he was born, and he said he was going to do a few decades, and then he would die. So a life is an interruption of death. You know, people are always thinking it's the other way around, to think death is an interruption of life. It's not. That's the way it is. We're there. And so, and in Ireland, of course, which is amazing that, not amazing, but it's delightful the way it is. They mourn marriages and celebrate death. You know, it's a couple of the guys, you know, in the pub and say, how did you hear about John? Oh, no, what? He's gone. What? Yeah, done, finished, done. He got married on Saturday. And that's the end of him.
So.
And then they say, well, it was did you go to Timmy's funeral the other night? Did we have a great time there? Just the singing was massive. And the storytelling was terrific. And the dance to clear the floor. And it was a great send-off for him altogether. Though, mind you, he was a bit of a, you know, he didn't deserve that. But, you know, they're always saying, never speak ill of the dead. Sure, it's the best time to speak ill of them. Sure, they can come back at you and punch you in the nose.
We're chatting, listeners, if you're joining us a few minutes late on It's Your Turn here on WISR today. A wonderful chat already with Malachy McCourt. And I just want to make sure that people don't get confused. Your late brother, Frank, as you mentioned, wrote Angela's Ashes, Pulitzer Prize winner, by the way.
Yes.
This is Frank's younger brother. Angela, by the way, was your mother. That's what Angela's Ashes referred to. And
right.
You have a wonderful little anecdote about visiting your mother as she was as she lay dying in the hospital.
Right.
Back in Ireland. Do you remember that story?
No, here.
It was here?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she came on a visit, Dave, and in 1958, mm-hmm. A holiday. She came over for a holiday. and then 1958, so, and then in 1981, she finished her holiday in the hospital here. She was still here.
Mm-hmm.
The holiday never finished. She did.
But you had not discussed funeral arrangements at that time.
Yeah, that's right, yes.
When you visited her, so you, I guess you kind of asked her about that?
Yes, and I said, would you like the traditional kind of a funeral and that kind of thing? Or, well, how about being cremated? And she just sort of looked at me and said, surprise me.
Wonderful.
That we cremated her.
Wonderful anecdote. Listeners, these are the kind of little tidbits you're going to find throughout Malachy McCourt's latest book. It's just out. It's called Death Be Not Fatal. We have a few more minutes that we're able to chat with Malachy. We could talk with him all day, quite frankly. But let us take a break here, and we'll come back and wrap up our conversation with him here on It's Your Turn on WISR right after these words. For so many of us, a loving pet is, well, it's a member of the family, isn't it? If you're looking for a veterinarian you can trust when it comes time for a checkup or treatment for a pet that's ill, consider Suburban Animal Clinic and Dr. Dennis Damon, Route 8 South of Butler, 4 miles south of Butler, right at the intersection of Route 8 South and Thorncrest Drive. Dr. Damon treats small animals, dogs, cats, all small animals, and exotic pets, too. If you have a question about illness, symptoms, shots, a checkup, if you need to talk to someone about concerns with an aging pet, or a pet near the end of life, you can trust Dr. Dennis Damon. He loves animals. He's a pet owner himself. Dr. Dennis Damon, veterinarian at Suburban Animal Clinic. Hours by appointment only, Monday through Saturday. Credit cards are accepted, and he makes house calls, too. Dr. Dennis Damon, Suburban Animal Clinic, Route 8, 4 miles south of Butler at the intersection of Route 8 and Thorncrest Drive. Phone 287-5289. Welcome back. Joining us a little bit late, that's fine. Dave Malarkey is my name, and you're listening to It's Your Turn here on WISR. Special guest visiting with us today by telephone from New York City. It's Malachy McCourt, and we're talking about his new book, Death Need Not Be Fatal. It's a memoir. Actually, it's almost like a wake, an Irish wake in written form, isn't it, Malachy?
That's funny. Well, I'm 85 and I'm in the departure lounge, and all my brothers now are dead. The three younger ones died when they were young, and then Frank died about 5-6 years ago. Then Mike died a year ago, and then Alfie, my youngest brother, died in July as well. So a year after he did. So it's I am the last standing member of that generation, and I look at my own mortality. And you know, it's very, two people die every second in the world. You know, 6,500 die every hour. And we don't know how long we have or anything. And I am, so that's, so I have no fear of any of that stuff. So I'm thoroughly enjoying my life. And they say, you don't believe in anything? I believe in everything. I believe in flowers, and I believe in sun and moonlight and stars. I believe in plants, and I love the roaring rivers, the Grand Canyon mountains, and I love the face of my wife. And if you want to see the face of God, I've been told, look into the face of a child, and that's my belief. And I look into the faces of my grandchildren, and I see God, and I see beauty, and I see morality and decency and generosity, and I'm just so delighted with myself.
Let me talk a little bit about your life. You were actually born in the United States. But your family then moved to Limerick in Ireland. You were very, very young. You were just a baby.
Yes. What happened was that my younger sister, there was my father and mother here, Frank, myself, and twin boys. And then a little girl arrives on. She was a beautiful little creature, Margaret Mary. And we just adored her, the four male boys, you know, looking at her. And she's a lovely little child. I remember her. I was only 3 and a half, but I do remember her well. Anyway, I woke up one in the middle of the night, and there's my father standing in the middle of the room, and his hands in his hands are this baby with her head dangling limply back and her arms dangling limply and her legs. She had died in the night. And that sent my mother into a terrific breakdown. She just spiraled into darkness and just sat staring, smoking. That's, you know, part of the Angela's ashes comes from that, the ashes on the end of her, because we used to watch the cigarette where the ashes fall off.
Yeah.
So then she couldn't recover from that. My father took to the drink, and neighbors and people and friends got together and gave us money. So there we were in the 30s in the middle of a massive worldwide depression, and we got on a ship and went to Ireland, and never, if ever, was frying pan to fire. That was it. So we got to Ireland, and we were not too welcome, so we're living in misery and poverty and darkness and despair and disease, all sorts of things. So then a year or so later, Eugene, one of the twins, got pneumonia and measles, and then he died. And then 6 months later, the other lad, Oliver, they said he died of a broken heart because his twin had died, and that was it. And in my school, we went to a kind of a holding pen for convicts, really. It was not really a school, but they just beat the hell out of us there. And 10 of my classmates died over a few years.
Oh,
so
my.
Frank says we belong to the Death of the Month Club. But we had great fun, though, when people died. That was great. That's why, you know, because they always got plenty to eat. That was the only time you ever got anything sweet and festive, you know, feast-like, was at wakes.
Now, you were
We longed for more of them.
This whole time, then, you were in Limerick, right?
We were in Limerick, yes, yeah.
On the banks of the Shannon.
And my father got the Irish divorce. He disappeared into England, yeah. Mm. And left her getting about the equivalent of about $2 a week or something. Mm-hmm. See, $1 was for change, for rent, and the rest went for all the other luxuries.
Wow.
The yacht and the limousine. And the
when did you come back to New York, Malachy?
I came back in 1952, and I landed, I came by ship, the good ship America. I think it was probably one of the last voyages it did make. And I got off down here at the east side, at the west side, and United States lines. And I often passed there, and I think, my God, 63 years ago I landed there, and I had exactly, and I remember well, $4 in my pocket.
Wow.
Frank had been drafted at the time for the Korean conflict, and but some of his friends came to meet me, and people said, what are you going to do? What are your, I was 20, and I didn't know what, I have no idea. I left school, Dave, when I was 13, because I was quite stupid, actually. I couldn't get it. And to this day, I don't know anything about grammar or anything like that, or punctuation. And I certainly don't know anything about mathematics or arithmetic or any of that stuff. But I did always love reading, and that's what sustained us. The library came to Limerick, and my God, if you ask me now, would I rather a book or a dinner? And I would, indeed, and many times I needed a dinner, but I would always opt for the book. And so that's what saved me, and what saved Frank, too, because he never went to high school either.
You, after you came back to the United States, you had quite a varied career. You were on stage, you were on TV, you were on radio, you were in a bunch of movies, you were an actor, and that's how you made your living, Malachy?
No, I went very swiftly. I always did a lot of mostly manual labor stuff, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I worked on the docks and I loaded ships, I loaded trucks. So I became a concrete inspector on the Jersey Turnpike. I was a dishwasher and so on and so forth. And but one night I went to the theater. I loved the theater, and so anyway, I thought, my God, it'd be great to be an actor. So I walked out of that theater, and then I turned around, went right back in, and I asked to speak to the boss, as I thought. I didn't know what they were called, and happened to be speaking to a producer, and it was an Irish play. And as it happened, they were one of the actors was dropping out, who was my age. So he said, "Do you have any experience?" And I said, "No, I'm Irish. I don't need it." And he laughed. So anyway, that's how I got into acting. I just walked in, and there it was.
Wow.
And then I did that, and then I went down around the corner to a bar, and there was the guy. Anyway, the guy who owned it was grumpy. He said, and I was bringing people. He said, "Serve them yourself," he said. So I got behind the bar, and I became a bartender just like that. And then a guy named Tom O'Malley, who liked what was happening with me, he put me on The Tonight Show with Jack Parr. And I said, "What am I, you know, being catapulted into all this stuff?" I didn't know. I was all swirling and whirling, and of course I'm drinking, and I don't know what the hell is happening. And so in about a little while, two guys came to me and said, "How about opening up your own bar?" I said, "Okay." So we opened up a bar, and it was an enormous success.
Mm.
And then I got a job on, they asked me to do radio and television, and and I just was thinking, here am I, this practically illiterate guy who can barely get two sentences together. What the hell am I doing here? And all I could say was, it's a great bloody country. I just absolutely love it. And I ran for governor in New York there in 206. I got almost 50,000 votes. So there we are. So what was the question, Dave?
Well, I just wanted to mention a couple. I mean, I know you did a lot of stage work. You were in a bunch of soap operas.
I did.
Also some movies. One of my favorites, The Molly Maguires.
Oh, my God,
with,
yeah.
Sean Connery was in that, right?
Sean Connery, yeah. Richard Harris, yeah. We did that up in northeast Pennsylvania.
I was going to say, that's where it's based. It's based in northeastern Pennsylvania, and it's a fabulous movie, yeah.
It is. It didn't do too well when it came out first because the Holy Mother Church was not too pleased about it, so they condemned it officially because it was church that in the days of the Molly Maguires, they condemned the Molly Maguires because they were a secret society and so forth, and of course the church wanted to keep on the side of the right side of the money. So they, in retrospect then, of course, they condemned the Molly Maguires, so people stayed away. But now it's kind of a classic.
It is.
And
yes.
I thought it was...
Well, listen, as I said before, my goodness, I could talk with you all afternoon here, but we must move on, and I know you've got things to do as well. Are your earlier works, like A Monk Swimming... and singing him my song, are they still available somewhere, like online or something?
They're still about in the history of Ireland and Danny Boy. They're all they're still extant, and I think that for the Catholics, I think A Monk Swimming always makes them laugh. How I got the title, because when I was a child, I got the name mixed up. Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee. Blessed art thou amongst women. I thought it said A Monk Swimming. That's how I got the title of A Monk Swimming.
The laughs just keep coming, folks, and there are a lot of them in Malachy's latest book, just out. It's a memoir entitled Death Need Not Be Fatal. Malachy McCord, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for the time, sir. Love talking
Thank
with you.
Thank you very much, David. Great to talk to you again. And keep going, my dear man.
Okay. Thanks
keep
a
around.
Lot. Yep. Bye-bye now.
All the best.
Midday lottery numbers for you today. The pick 2 is 7575. The pick 3, 327-327. Pick 4, 8113. The pick 5, 03284. Wild ball for each of those is 0. The treasure hunt, 7, 21, 22, 25, and 28. Estimated jackpot for tomorrow's treasure hunt is $10,000.
The Young Funeral Home of Butler invites you to stop by their Jefferson Street location, downtown Butler, to talk about pre-arrangements. Not the easiest thing to do, but necessary. And the Young family will walk you through the process, making it very comfortable and really easy to take care of. You'll experience peace of mind knowing that your wishes and plans will be carried out to the last detail. Call the Young Funeral Home in Butler today to make an appointment with a member of the Young family. Generations of the Young family have been caring for generations of Butler families for well over 40 years. The Young Funeral Home, West Jefferson Street in Butler.
Listeners, we have quite a treat for you on the next segment of It's Your Turn here on WISR. And if you're joining us a little bit late today, that's fine. My name is Dave Malarkey. Our guest joins us by telephone from the United Kingdom, believe it or not. We're chatting with Tristan Gooley. Tristan, nice to meet you. Nice to have you with us for a few minutes here today.
Good to meet you too, Dave. Thanks for having me on.
You have published a fascinating new book, the title of which is The Lost Art of Reading Nature's Signs. And I do mean this is a fascinating book. We wanted to chat with you about it for a few minutes. I suppose there are a lot of folks, I'm sure, in the UK and certainly here in the US, we are so surrounded these days by telephones, smartphones, computers, TVs. Maybe this art of reading nature's signs is becoming a lost art in the not-too-distant future, Tristan.
I think it is, and I think it's accelerating. I can remember about 10 years ago, it started to become quite common that you'd see people outdoors staring at a screen in terms of understanding where they were. And now it's quite rare if you go a day without seeing that. I mean, that's fast change. I mean, humanity didn't change really noticeably for thousands of years, and then the last 100 years, things are just getting faster and faster. But I'm not anti-technology. It's just I think we can have the best of both worlds. We don't have to lose all of these wonderful skills that our ancestors had. We can have the smartphone in our pocket, but before we spend all day staring at it, we might want to just look at some of the things around us and find the fun clues there.
And it is fun, and that's what we're going to talk about today, and that's what you talk about a great deal in your book. Listeners, a little bit about our guest. Tristan Gooley is a writer. He is also an internationally renowned navigator. He has led expeditions on 5 continents. He's climbed mountains in Europe, Africa, and Asia. And perhaps most astonishingly, he is the only living person to have both flown solo and sailed single-handedly across the Atlantic. So if there's anybody who's qualified to talk about reading nature's signs, it's our guest, Tristan Gooley. Let's talk about some of the things that I've just kind of noted as I've glanced through the review copy of your book that I have here that have fascinated me. For example, I never heard about being able to use the leaves on a tree as a compass. Can you talk a little bit about that, Tristan?
Yeah, it's not a dark art. It's just a case of noticing a difference between the leaves on one side of a tree and another. On the south side of trees, the trees have different types of leaves. They have what are known as sun leaves because they get more light there. And these leaves are typically smaller and lighter in color than the leaves on the north side where less light gets to, and the leaves are bigger and darker in color.
What about, does the sun have something to do with how you can deduce why cafes are all on one side of the street if you're in a new town?
Yeah, I sort of see everything we see outdoors is a clue to something, even other people. So we can sort of notice the way people move through a town and start to use that and the way we might use animals in the wild. So to give you a couple of examples, if you're really lost in a big town and you just want to get a handle on, you know, one place, if you go against the flow of people in the morning or with the flow of people in the late afternoon, you'll find a station because all the people are, you know, going to work or heading home from work.
Hmm.
But in terms of the cafes, we, in hot parts of the world, we head into shade when we can, and in cold parts of the world, we head into sun when we can. And every single town is actually mapped in a small way using these shady and sunny areas. So if there's a street that runs north-south, you'll find that there's one side that gets the sun in the morning, one side that gets the sun later in the day. I mean, I first noticed this in Edinburgh in Scotland. There's one side of a street there, it's all cafes, and that gets the sun in the morning. The other side of the street is all restaurants and bars, so that's more popular in the evening, Edinburgh not being the hottest part of the world.
And this is a classic example of how this is really very easy to deduce. We just think it's complex sometimes in nature. You tell a story in the very beginning of your book, The Lost Art of Reading Nature's Signs. You were somewhere on the north coast of French Brittany, I think, and you said you were on holiday and noticed a couple that came out of a hotel walking down to the beach, and within a matter of seconds, you had deduced, without even thinking about it, that they were newlyweds. But there were several clues, new rings, the way they looked at each other, so on and so forth. You deduced that they were newlyweds probably from Europe, and it turns out you were absolutely correct. And we can do that in nature if we just know a few of the clues.
That's absolutely right, and that's part of what makes me passionate about my work, is that I don't think anybody's surprised these days by the Holmesian, the Sherlock Holmesian way of looking at the world. You know, we can tell stuff about strangers, we can solve crimes. You know, a lot of our TV and films are using this kind of thinking. You know, how do we find the murderer? Is it from the footprint or something a bit subtler? But so few people have taken the time to realize that part of our brain, that part of the brain we love using, clearly, think of all the books and all the programs and everything, we can use that part of the brain and have just as much fun outdoors. Every cloud, every star, every plant, every animal is part of this great puzzle of nature. And if we view it that way, every moment outdoors becomes a fun and rewarding game of detective work.
Some of the things that you talk about in your book might seem a little complicated to the novice who's not a navigator such as you. You talk about how to tell the time using the stars. Can you chat about that for a moment?
Yeah, sure. I mean, like pretty much everything in the book, it's putting a couple of simple ideas together to come up with something which maybe sounds new and strange to people. But if we look to the north, and in the book I give methods for finding the North Star, it's quite straightforward. If you haven't tried it, you just find a shape called the Big Dipper and use that to find the North Star. Some of your listeners may have done it. But once we've done that, we can use that shape and that star because the stars wheel anti-clockwise around the North Star. So once we just look at that and we draw a couple of lines just with our eyes in the sky and we do a couple of simple sums, it's really not tough math. It just takes a few seconds, and I set the method out in the book. And then we can tell the time, you know, to within a quarter of an hour just by looking at the stars. And a lot of people think, but I can get it a lot more accurately using my smartphone or my watch or whatever. So why do I need that? And I wouldn't answer by saying you do need it. I answer by saying you don't need it, but a lot of the most fun things in the world are totally unnecessary. Music, sculpture, dance, all of the arts, really, we could say are unnecessary. But what a boring world without some of the unnecessary things.
You mentioned how this can be fun, and I'm thinking I can only concur. When I was a kid, a little boy up until certainly early teens, the kids in my neighborhood, my brother and I, we spent a lot of time in the woods, and we were much more in tune with nature then. When we got sophisticated as adults, it was fun when we were doing that. It was fun, Tristan.
Yeah. I mean, the outdoors should be seen as the biggest, cheapest playground there is for adults as well as kids.
By the way, Tristan mentioned that he has a map and some illustrations about talking about using the stars. There are 75 photos and illustrations throughout this book, so that makes it even easier to understand some of these things. You talk about how you can tell how heavy the rain is simply by examining the colors in a rainbow. How do you do that?
Yeah, again, it's a nice simple idea, but perhaps a bit new to some people, that the colors in a rainbow come because the sunlight hits a raindrop and gets bounced around back into our eyes. But the type of raindrop will change how that light reaches us. And every single color is telling us something about the type of rain out there. To keep it nice and simple, I mean, I go through every color and every style of rainbow in the book, but to keep it nice and simple for now, if you see a really strong red color in the rainbow, that means there are especially big raindrops, because we just don't get the color red unless sunlight hits really big raindrops. So quite often you'll see a rainbow and it's just a bit of orange there, but if you suddenly see one and you go, wow, I can really see that red, then you know there's really, really big raindrops out there. So I use the line in the book, lots of red means a wet head.
There are a couple of old bromides that I can remember from childhood. Take the opportunity to ask you whether they're accurate or not. I can remember my mom always saying, if there's a ring around the moon at night, that means rain in the not-too-distant future. True, false, or you never heard of it?
Yes, it's actually one of those. In the book, I go through a lot of the weather lore you may have seen, and I sort of say true or false and explain, and that's one of the ones that actually does work, because I mean, no sign on its own is guaranteed, but that's one of the really strong ones, and all cultures in the world have noticed it. So if we take the Native Americans, they had a traditional saying about the sun going into the teepee, and that was the halo you're talking about. So it doesn't matter, actually, if it's the moon, the sun, or stars. If you see a faint ring around something, a halo, then what we're seeing there is a certain type of cloud, one of the high clouds, cirrostratus, and that's part of a change from good to bad weather. So on its own, it doesn't, it's not 100%, But it means, okay, now we need to start tuning in. And if you notice the wind change direction, then you can be fairly certain that some bad weather's on the way.
By the way, Tristan Gooley did a great deal of research in preparing the material in this book, including among Native peoples. You just mentioned Native American Indian culture. There are similar Native cultures around the world that you've explored, and some of that research is included in your book.
Yes, I spent time with the Tuareg in Libya in the Sahara Desert, and some time with the Dayak in the heart of Borneo, and all the time I'm just you know, trying to absorb their way of looking at the world. And it takes, you know, it's the first day or two, you know, we see the world so differently. It takes me a couple of days before I even understand sometimes what they're trying to tell me, and it takes a whole lot longer to actually get the detail out. But then it's always worthwhile, because once I've understood what they're looking at, I can bring it back. And what's so important to me is this information isn't just relevant if you're in the middle of the jungle, in the middle of the desert.